This is Audible.
Knowledge Products presents The United States at War, narrated by George C. Scott. This is the American Revolution, Part 2.
Events in Boston were getting out of hand. On June 10, 1768, the Liberty, a sloop owned by John Hancock, was seized for illegally importing Madeira wine. Angry Bostonians attacked the customs officers. One of these officers, Benjamin Harrison, told the story.
"We were pursued by the mob, which by this time was increased to a great multitude. The onset was begun by throwing dirt at me, which was presently succeeded by volleys of stones, brickbats, sticks, or anything that came to hand. In this manner, I run the gauntlet near 200 yards, my poor son following behind, endeavoring to shelter his father by receiving the strokes of many of the stones, till at length he became equally an object of their resentment, was knocked down and then laid hold of by the legs, arms, and hair of his head, and in that manner dragged along in a most barbarous and cruel manner. I received a violent blow on the breast, which had like to have brought me to the ground, and I verily believe if I had fallen, I should never have got up again, the people to all appearance being determined on blood and murder."
This incident convinced Commodore Hood of the Royal Navy that Boston was on the brink of revolt. He advised his superiors in London,
"What has been so often foretold is now come to pass. The good people of Boston seem ready and ripe for open revolt, and nothing, it is imagined, can prevent it but immediate armed force."
General Gage, commander-in-chief of British forces in America, was of a similar mind. He wrote to the government,
"If a determined resolution is taken to enforce, at all events, a due submission to that dependence on the parent state to which all colonies have ever been subjected, you cannot act with too much vigor. Quash this spirit at a blow, without too much regard to the expense, and it will prove economy in the end."
Rumors circulated of plans to garrison soldiers in Boston. One Bostonian warned,
"Nothing would so soon throw the people into a flame. No one measure I could think of would so effectually drive them into resolutions which in the end would prove detrimental to Great Britain."
For once, rumors had understated the case. Almost the entire British garrison stationed in Halifax, Nova Scotia, around 700 soldiers, arrived in Boston in September 1768. An additional 1,000 soldiers were on their way from Ireland. As British warships sailed into Boston Harbor, they lined up in a menacing battle formation, their broadsides facing the town. Bostonians were hostile, but restrained. Local officials refused to provide quarters for the troops, so the British rented various buildings scattered throughout the town. This was asking for trouble. The brutal punishments inflicted by British officers on their soldiers made desertions a constant threat, and now, without a central barracks or bivouac where the soldiers could be watched, they began to desert at an alarming rate. Some 70 in the first 2 weeks. Consequently, the British tried to seal off Boston to prevent soldiers from escaping. Sentinels were ordered to keep a sharp watch, and they faced hundreds of lashes if they let a deserter slip by. At night, sentinels challenged passers-by, who were supposed to respond by shouting, "Friend!" Few Bostonians were willing to play this game, so tempers flared as civilians confronted soldiers. Sam Adams was outraged by the military presence in his town.
"When these sentinels call upon everyone who passes by to know who comes there, as the phrase is, I take it to be in the highest degree impertinent, unless they can show a legal authority for so doing. There is something in it which looks like the town was altogether under the government and control of the military power. And as long as the inhabitants are fully persuaded that this is not the case at present, and moreover hope and believe that it never will be, It has a natural tendency to irritate the minds of all who have a just sense of honor and think they have the privilege of walking the streets without being controlled.
The civil rights of Bostonians were in jeopardy. They responded by affirming their right to bear arms in self-defense. One anonymous writer declared,
"It is a natural right which the people have reserved to themselves to keep arms for their own defense, and it is to be made use of when the sanctions of society and law are found insufficient to restrain the violence of oppression."
Bostonians were getting touchy, to say the least, but they had reason to cheer on August 1st, 1769. On that day, Governor Bernard sailed for England, never to return. Bostonians were not exactly sorry to see the governor go, as they indicated by posting a broadside with a farewell poem.
"Go, Bernard, thou minion, to thy country go, for Boston loud proclaims you freedom's foe. Go on, ye pilferer, with all the rage that half-starved spaniels for a bone engage. Go, join in concert with the croaking frogs, or howl in chorus with a pack of dogs. With monkeys go, and chatter on a stage, or turn a mastiff, and each cur engage. Better, do worse. Turn pander, pimp, or slave. Turn highwayman, turn murderer, or knave."
The military occupation of Boston caused many problems and solved none. By the summer of 1769, this was apparent even to General Gage, the British commander-in-chief.
"The people were as lawless and licentious after the troops arrived as they were before. They were there, contrary to the wishes of the council, assembly, magistrates, and people, and seemed only offered to abuse and ruin."
Two regiments were withdrawn from Boston, but two remained. Scuffles between soldiers and civilians became more frequent. Then on the evening of March 5th, 1770, tragedy struck. A scuffle escalated until British soldiers killed five Bostonians and wounded several others. Eyewitnesses gave conflicting accounts of the Boston massacre, but the subsequent trial spoke well for American justice. The British officer in charge, Captain Preston, was defended by John Adams and acquitted by an American jury. Sam Adams disagreed with the verdict, but he believed there was a more important issue involved. Incidents like the Boston Massacre were bound to occur whenever soldiers were garrisoned among civilians. Bostonians agreed. They wanted the soldiers out of Boston. Thomas Hutchinson, the acting governor, partially complied. He withdrew one of the two regiments from Boston to Castle William in Boston Harbor. This wasn't good enough for the Americans, so Sam Adams paid a visit to the governor. If Hutchinson had the power to remove one regiment, Adams declared bluntly, he had the power to remove the other. Adams continued with a thinly veiled threat.
"It is at your peril if you refuse. The meeting is composed of 3,000 people. They are become impatient. 1,000 men are already arrived in the neighborhood, and the whole country is in motion. Night is approaching. An immediate answer is expected. Both regiments or none."
The governor capitulated to avoid, in his words, a perfect convulsion. Boston was thereby spared additional violence. From 1771 to 1783, annual orations were given in Massachusetts to commemorate the Boston Massacre. Typically, these included condemnations of standing armies, that is, professional armies maintained in peacetime. Opposition to standing armies had long been part of the radical Whig ideology, which profoundly influenced American attitudes. The Boston Massacre reinforced this traditional hostility. Consider the oration given in 1772 by Dr. Joseph Warren, a resistance leader who later died at the Battle of Bunker Hill.
"Soldiers are taught to consider arms as the only arbiters by which every dispute is to be decided between contending states. They are instructed implicitly to obey their commanders, without inquiring into the justice of the cause they are engaged to support. Hence it is that they are ever to be dreaded as the ready engines of tyranny and oppression."
For many Americans, citizen militias, not standing armies, were the proper way to defend a free society. The Boston merchant, John Hancock, made this point in his memorial oration for 1774.
Since standing armies are so hurtful to a state, perhaps my countrymen may demand some substitute, some other means of rendering us secure against the incursions of a foreign enemy. But can you be one moment at a loss? Will not a well-disciplined militia afford you ample security against foreign foes? From a well-regulated militia, we have nothing to fear. Their interest is the same with that of the state. They do not jeopardize their lives for a master who considers them only as the instruments of his ambition, and whom they regard only as the daily dispenser of the scanty pittance of bread and water. No, they fight for their houses, their lands, for the wives, their children, for all who claim the tenderest names and are held dearest in their hearts. They fight for their liberty, for themselves, and for their God.
On March 5, 1770, 5 Bostonians had been killed by British soldiers in what became known as the Boston Massacre. Those soldiers had been sent to Boston because of resistance to the Townshend Revenue Act. Ironically, March 5th was also the day when a new English Prime Minister, Lord North, opened debate in Parliament on revising the Townshend duties. English merchants had petitioned for repeal because they were smarting from an American boycott. 3 positions on this issue emerged during the parliamentary debates. Some members favored the repeal of all duties because the American boycott cost more in lost business than the duties brought in. Hardliners, on the other hand, opposed any changes whatsoever. A repeal, they argued, would mean caving in to American demands. Prime Minister North favored a middle course. He wanted to repeal all the Townshend duties except the duty on tea. This duty should remain as a symbol of British authority. It would reaffirm Parliament's right to tax the American colonies. Lord North got his way. On April 12, 1770, the duties on glass, paper, and paint were removed. The tax on tea remained. This partial repeal caused problems for the American boycott. Many merchants had agreed to continue their boycott until all the duties had been repealed, but now some merchants had second thoughts. New Yorkers decided to limit the boycott to tea, the one item still taxed. A committee of Philadelphia merchants responded to New York's decision with indignation.
"You have certainly weakened that union of the colonies on which their safety depends. We cannot forbear telling you that however you may color your proceedings, we think you have, in the day of trial, deserted the cause of liberty and your country."
This protest accomplished nothing. New York merchants resumed trade with England, and they were followed by merchants in Pennsylvania, Maryland, South Carolina, and other colonies. By mid-October 1770, even Bostonians had given up the ghost. Trade with England flourished as Americans replenished their depleted stocks. The great non-importation movement was dead. The 2 years following the breakdown of non-importation have been called the period of quiet, the period of calm, the period of American disunity, and even the period of conservative reaction. These labels are used because between 1771 and 1773, there was no great issue around which radicals could rally opposition to Britain. This is not to say Americans had suddenly become obedient British subjects. Far from it. They continued to smuggle, and they continued to use violence against customs officers. The most famous clash during the period of quiet occurred off the coast of Rhode Island when a British naval schooner, the Gaspé, ran aground in June 1772. The Gaspé was commanded by Lieutenant William Duddingston, an arrogant man who had incurred the wrath of Rhode Islanders for his overly zealous seizure of merchant vessels. When the people of Providence learned that Duddingston had beached his schooner, they sought revenge. Led by John Brown, the town's wealthiest merchant, a party boarded the Gaspé. A British sailor described the fight.
"We fired our pistols.
on which they boarded us upon the starboard bow and fired a number of small arms. Immediately, Lieutenant Duddingston, her commander, cried out, "Good God, I'm done for!" He was wounded in his groin and arm. When they had got possession of the schooner, they used the people very ill by pinioning of them and throwing them into their boats, and refused the lieutenant and officers any necessaries but what they had on, and not even suffered the commanding officer to have his papers, and robbed his servant of several silver spoons, and throwed his linen and apparel overboard. We were then sent ashore. I remained on the beach, and about 3:30 saw the schooner on fire.
A Royal Commission of Inquiry was appointed to probe the Gaspé incident. Lord Dartmouth, Secretary of State for the Colonies, stated the intentions of the British government.
The offence is an act of high treason, that is to say, levying war against the King. It is His Majesty's intention that the persons concerned in the burning of the Gaspé schooner and the other violences which attended that daring insult should be brought to England to be tried.
If convicted of high treason, those who participated in the Gaspé affair faced a horrible execution. The English jurist Sir William Blackstone described the penalty.
The penalty is that the offender be drawn to the gallows, that he be hanged by the neck and then cut down alive, that his entrails be taken out and burned while he is yet alive, that his head be cut off, that his body be divided into 4 parts, and his head and quarters be at the King's disposal.
The Rhode Islanders who stormed the Gaspé escaped this gruesome fate because no witnesses could be found to testify against them. The British government dropped the case, but some Americans were alarmed by the threat to bypass colonial courts and hold trials in England instead. This threat would soon have serious repercussions. Boston radicals needed a controversy to reawaken American resistance. Soon, one was handed to them on a silver platter. In the summer of 1772, on orders from the home government, Governor Thomas Hutchinson announced that his salary would now be paid by the British government, rather than by the Massachusetts Assembly. This put control of the colonial government more firmly in British hands. Later that summer, more bad news arrived. Judges were also to receive permanent salaries from the Crown. Sam Adams described the outrage of many Bostonians.
The news was like thunder in the ears of all but a detestable and detested few. Even those who had been inclined to think favorably of the governor and the judges were alarmed at it. And indeed, what honest and sensible man or woman could contemplate it without horror? We all began to shudder at the prospect of the same tragical scenes being enacted in this country, which are recorded in the English history as having been acted when their judges were the mere creatures, dependents, and tools of the crown. Such an indignation was discovered and expressed by almost everyone at so daring an insult upon a free people that it was difficult to keep our resentment within its proper bounds.
Sam Adams now had the controversy he needed to revive the flagging spirit of resistance. He wrote in the Boston Gazette,
"Is it not high time for the people of this country explicitly to declare whether they will be freemen or slaves? Let every town assemble. Let associations and combinations be everywhere set to consult and recover our just rights."
Adams worked feverishly to organize Bostonians. A town meeting petitioned Governor Hutchinson to convene the legislature. Hutchinson refused and scolded the petitioners. Undaunted, Adams organized another town meeting attended by about 300 Bostonians. There he made the following resolution.
"I move that a committee of correspondence be appointed to consist of 21 persons to state the rights of the colonists and of this province in particular, as men and Christians and as subjects, and to communicate and publish the same to the several towns, and to the world as the sense of this town, with the infringements and violations thereof that have been, or from time to time may be made.
On November 2, 1772, the town meeting approved this resolution, thereby establishing the Boston Committee of Correspondence. This was a bold step with tremendous significance. Rebuffed by their governor, Bostonians had formed an organization which operated independently of the legally established government. Defenders of the crown recognized the revolutionary implications of the Boston Committee of Correspondence. One critic called it the foulest, subtlest, and most venomous serpent that ever issued from the eggs of sedition. According to Governor Hutchinson, the committee was composed of deacons, atheists, and black-hearted fellows whom one would not choose to meet in the dark. The chairman of the committee was James Otis, a man revered for his services to the radical cause. But Otis suffered from bouts of insanity, and Governor Hutchinson exploited this when attacking the committee.
"You may judge of this committee by their chairman, who is but just now discharged from his guardian, and is still, once in a few days, as mad as ever. The effect of strong drink."
Some members of the committee, Hutchinson suggested darkly, secretly favored American independence. He was probably right. The Boston Committee of Correspondence quickly prepared its first report. Commonly known as the Boston Pamphlet, this report was one of the most important documents of the Revolutionary era. It opened with a statement by Sam Adams.
"Among the natural rights of the colonists are these. First, a right to life. Secondly, a right to liberty. Thirdly, to property, with the right to support and defend them in the best manner they can."
After further arguments, supported with quotations from John Locke, Adams closed with these words.
"The colonists have been branded with the odious names of traitors and rebels only for complaining of their grievances. How long such treatment will or ought to be borne is submitted."
The second part of the Boston Pamphlet was written by Dr. Joseph Warren. Warren penned a comprehensive list of colonial grievances, many of which would later appear in the Declaration of Independence. Among other things, Warren condemned the methods used by customs officers.
"Our houses and even our bedchambers are exposed to be ransacked. Our boxes, chests, and trunks broke open, ravaged, and plundered by wretches whom no prudent man would venture to employ even as menial servants whenever they are pleased to say they suspect there are in the house wares, etc., for which the duties have not been paid. Flagrant instances of the wanton exercise of this power have frequently happened in this and other seaport towns. By this, we are cut off from that domestic security which renders the lives of the most unhappy in some measure agreeable. Those officers may, under color of law and the cloak of a general warrant, break through the sacred rights of the domicile, ransack men's houses, destroy their securities, carry off their property, and, with little danger to themselves, commit the most horrid murders."
This Boston pamphlet was approved by a town meeting and sent to other towns in Massachusetts. Its effect was electrifying. Some 80 towns followed Boston's example and formed their own committees. These developments worried Governor Hutchinson. He convened the Massachusetts legislature and delivered a carefully reasoned speech on the sovereignty of Parliament.
"I know no line that can be drawn between the supreme authority of Parliament and the total independence of the colonies. It is impossible that there should be two independent legislatures in one and the same state. For although there may be but one head, the king, yet two legislative bodies will make two governments as distinct as the kingdoms of England and Scotland before the Union."
With this either-or reasoning, Hutchinson hoped to turn back the tide of rebellion, but he miscalculated. The House of Representatives drafted a reply, which was given its finished form by John Adams. According to Adams, if no line could be drawn between subservience to Parliament and independence from Parliament, then the colonies were independent.
"If there be no such line, the consequence is either that the colonies are vassals of the Parliament or that they are totally independent. as it cannot be supposed to have been the intentions of the parties in the compact that we should be reduced to a state of vassalage, the conclusion is that it was their sense that we were thus independent.
Thus, while affirming their allegiance to the king, Bostonians also asserted their independence from Parliament. Governor Hutchinson had unwittingly nudged the radicals closer to revolution. With their committees of correspondence, the people of Massachusetts had established organizations which could unify them in time of crisis. The next step was to form committees in every colony. The lead in this endeavor was taken by Virginia. Recall that after the Gaspé incident, the British government had expressed its intention to hold trials on colonial matters in England instead of in the colonies. This encroachment on colonial rights alarmed Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and other members of the Virginia legislature. In March 1773, this legislature erected a permanent committee of correspondence. The Virginia Committee of Correspondence invited other colonial legislatures to establish similar committees. Within a year, all had agreed. To appreciate the revolutionary significance of these committees, we must understand that in most of the colonies, royally appointed governors could dissolve the provincial assemblies. Governors used this power during crises to dampen anti-government protests. The committees of correspondence defied this power of governors. They were established as standing committees. That is, they functioned whether or not the assemblies remained in session. Thus, the committees of correspondence could mobilize public opinion without official approval. An intercolonial organization was now in place to deal with a future crisis. That crisis was not long in coming. It involved the unrepealed tax from the towns and duties. The tax on tea. In May 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act. This act was designed to assist the financially troubled East India Company, a monopoly corporation with vast commercial interests. The East India Company enjoyed the exclusive right to import products from the Far East into Britain. Chinese tea, said to be more valuable than gold, was the company's most lucrative commodity, accounting for over 90% of its commercial profits. After importing tea into Britain, the company was required to auction it off to other merchants. Some of these merchants then exported the tea to the American colonies. By law, this was virtually the only tea permitted in the colonies. Of course, to pass a law is one thing, but to enforce it is another. Americans found duty-free Dutch tea, otherwise known as smuggled tea, to be considerably cheaper than the dutied tea offered by English merchants. This preference for cheap tea was not peculiar to Americans. Over half of the tea consumed in England was smuggled, and English smugglers, like their American counterparts, could be quite indignant when their free trade activities were interrupted by government. Consider, for example, this colorful letter, written by an English smuggler to Captain Bursack of the Speedwell, a British revenue cutter.
Sir, oh, that I had been there with my company for thy sake, when thou tookest them men of mine on board the Speedwell cutter on Monday, the 14th of December. I would drove thee and thy gang to hell where thou belongest, thou devil incarnate. Go down, thou hellhound, unto thy kennel below, and bathe thyself in that sulphurous lake that has been so long prepared for such as thee, for it is time the world was rid of such a monster. Thou art no man, but a devil, thou fiend. O Lucifer, I hope thou wilt soon fall into hell like a star from the sky, there to lie unpitied and unrelented of any for ever and ever, which God grant of his infinite mercy. Amen.
Smuggling made it difficult for the East India Company to sell its tea at its monopoly price. After passage of the Townsend duties, the company's problems were further aggravated by the American boycott of tea. By late 1772, the company had 17 million pounds of surplus tea sitting in warehouses. The East India Company went to the government for help. Parliament responded with the Tea Act. This act allowed the company to bypass middlemen and export its tea directly to the American colonies. The Tea Act also provided for a drawback or refund of duties previously paid in England. This provision was designed to lower the price of tea exported to America, thus making English tea competitive with smuggled Dutch tea. But the Tea Act contained a catch. The company was still required to pay the Townsend duty on tea entering the colonies. This lingering tea tax would soon precipitate the Boston Tea Party. In the summer of 1773, the East India Company shipped nearly 600,000 pounds of tea to the colonies. Four ships were sent to Boston, one to New York, one to Philadelphia, and one to Charleston. When Americans learned that East India Company tea was en route, they worried that a precedent was about to be set. A Londoner, sympathetic to America, wrote to a friend in New York.
Being a great schemer, Lord North struck out the plan of the East India Company sending tea to America, hoping thereby to outwit us and to establish the Townsend Act effectually, which will forever after be pleaded as precedent for every imposition the Parliament of Great Britain shall think proper to saddle us with. It is much to be wished that the Americans will convince Lord North that they are not yet ready to have the yoke of slavery riveted about their necks, and send back the tea whence it came.
This letter, reprinted in newspapers throughout America, articulated the chief objection to East India Company tea. Americans feared payment of the tea tax would set a dangerous precedent, but Americans feared the East India Company for another reason. It ruled parts of India with a cruel hand, causing widespread famine and death. In a widely circulated pamphlet, John Dickinson recounted the crimes of this monopoly company.
Their conduct in Asia for some years past has given ample proof how little they regard the law of nations, the rights, liberties, or lives of men. They have levied war, excited rebellions, dethroned princes, and sacrificed millions for the sake of gain. The revenue of mighty kingdoms have centered in their coffers, and these, not being sufficient to glut their avarice, they have, by the most unparalleled barbarities, extortions, and monopolies, stripped the miserable inhabitants of their property and reduced whole provinces to indigence and ruin. 1,500,000 perished by famine in 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but this company and its servants engrossed all the necessities of life and set them at so high a rate that the poor could not purchase them. Thus, having drained the sources of that immense wealth, they now, it seems, cast their eyes to America as a new threat, whereupon to exercise their talents of rapine, oppression, and cruelty. The monopoly of tea is, I dare say, but a small part of the plan they have formed to strip us of our property.
What strategy would prevent the sale of East India Company tea in America? Perhaps Americans could refuse to purchase the tea. This promised little success, however. Officially, Americans had been boycotting English tea for years. Unofficially, many Americans had resumed drinking English tea after the partial repeal of the Townsend duties in 1770. Resistance leaders decided on another strategy based on their successful opposition to the Stamp Act in 1765. That act had been nullified by forcing stamp distributors to resign. The East India Company had consigned 13 American firms to receive and sell its tea. If these consignees could be persuaded to resign, there would be no one to accept the tea when it arrived in America. New York blazed the trail. There, the Sons of Liberty published an ominous resolution.
Whoever shall aid or abet or in any manner assist in the introduction of tea from any place whatsoever into this country while it is subject by a British Act of Parliament to the payment of a duty for the purpose of raising a revenue in America, he shall be deemed an enemy to the liberties of America.
The New York consignees were subjected to threats and intimidation. A letter which appeared in the New York Journal warned the consignees,
"It will be impossible to shield or screen yourselves from the many darts that will incessantly be leveled against your persons. 1,000 avenues to death would be perpetually open to receive and swallow you, and 10,000 uplifted shafts ready to strike the fatal stroke whenever a favorable opportunity is offered for the purpose."
Understandably, the New York consignees resigned. Opposition in Philadelphia followed the same pattern, and yielded the same results. Intimidation and violence did not work in Boston, however, where two of the consignees were sons of Governor Hutchinson. For years, Hutchinson had been at loggerheads with Boston radicals. Indeed, his house had been destroyed during resistance to the Stamp Act. Hutchinson was determined to see law and order prevail. On Sunday, November 28th, a ship anchored in Boston Harbor. It was the Dartmouth, one of four ships transporting East India Company tea to Boston. The day after the Dartmouth's arrival, broadsides were posted throughout Boston.
Friends, brethren, countrymen, the hour of destruction, or manly opposition to the machinations of tyranny, stares you in the face.
Church bells pealed as thousands of Bostonians crowded into the Old South Meeting House. This meeting called for the tea to be returned to England without payment of duties. Governor Hutchinson refused, and the law was on his side. The Dartmouth had officially docked and so was legally required to pay duties on its cargo. Meanwhile, 25 militiamen were posted on Griffin's Wharf to prevent the tea from being unloaded. Governor Hutchinson figured he would win this standoff. If the Dartmouth's cargo was not unloaded within 20 days, the government could seize it. This meant that on December 17th, the tea would be unloaded by customs officers supported by the Army and Navy. Before long, two more tea-laden ships docked at Griffin's Wharf, the Eleanor and the Beaver. Armed guards prevented the unloading of tea from these ships as well. On the morning of December 16th, 5,000 people crowded into the Old South Meeting House. Only one day was left until customs officers would forcibly unload the Dartmouth's tea. Bostonians sent a final request to Governor Hutchinson. Would he permit the Dartmouth to return to England? It was nearly dark when a messenger returned with Hutchinson's answer. No. Sam Adams rose and announced that nothing more could be done. This was a signal. Cries echoed through the hall. Boston Harbor, a teapot tonight. Hurrah for Griffin's Wharf. The Mohawks are come. Every man to his tent. A war whoop came from the gallery, followed by war whoops from men at the doorway who were disguised as Indians. Then more men in Indian garb swept down Milk Street into Hutchinson Street and from there to Griffin's Wharf. The Boston Tea Party was underway. Accounts of this event vary widely. Here is one report from a Boston newspaper.
The Indians immediately repaired on board Captain Hall's ship, where they hoisted out the chests of tea, and when upon deck, strove the chests and emptied the tea overboard. Having cleared this ship, they proceeded to Captain Bruce's, and then to Captain Coffin's brig. They applied themselves so dexterously to the destruction of this commodity that in the space of 3 hours they broke up 342 chests, which was the whole number in those vessels, and discharged their contents into the dock. When the tide rose, it floated the broken chests and the tea, insomuch that the surface of the water was filled therewith a considerable way from the south part of the town to Dorchester Neck, and lodged on the shores. There was the greatest care taken to prevent the tea from being purloined by the populace, one or two being detected in endeavouring to pocket a small quantity, were stripped of their acquisitions and very roughly handled.
The Boston Indians were careful not to damage property other than tea.
It is worthy of remark that although a considerable quantity of goods were still remaining on board the vessels, no injury was sustained. Such attention to private property was observed that a small padlock belonging to the captain of one of the ships being broke, another was procured and sent to him.
Bostonians had destroyed tea worth £9,000. John Adams was overjoyed.
This is the most significant movement of all. There is a dignity, a majesty, a sublimity in this last effort of the patriots that I greatly admire. This destruction of the tea is so bold, so daring, so firm, intrepid, and inflexible, and it must have important consequences, and so lasting, that I cannot but consider it as an epoch in history.
The English public boiled with indignation. Benjamin Franklin was in London at the time, and he remarked,
I suppose we never had, since we were a people,
so few friends in Britain. The violent destruction of the tea seems to have united all parties against us.
Prime Minister North appeared before Parliament and demanded retaliation.
The Americans have tarred and feathered your subjects, plundered your merchants, burnt your ships, denied all obedience to your laws and authority, yet so clement and so long forbearing has our conduct been that it is incumbent on us now to take a different course. Whatever may be the consequences, we must risk something. If we do not, all is over.
Parliament rallied around North and passed four bills known as the Coercive Acts. The Port of Boston was ordered closed until reparations were paid and until Bostonians learned to respect law and order. The Charter of Massachusetts was altered to give the Crown greater powers. If citizens of Massachusetts accused a soldier or officer of the Crown of a capital crime, the governor could transfer the trial to England. And lastly, the Massachusetts governor was empowered to lodge British soldiers in privately owned buildings if barracks were unavailable. These coercive acts were based on a fundamental misunderstanding that had haunted the British government for years. The government received much of its information about America from colonial governors, and these governors often portrayed the resistance movement in a deceptive light. The common people, it was said, had been duped by a handful of radical agitators, especially in Massachusetts. Few British politicians seemed to understand that common Americans had minds of their own, and that animosity to Britain extended far beyond the borders of Massachusetts. Thus, the coercive acts were designed to make an example of Massachusetts and thereby cow other colonies into submission. But they had the opposite effect. Upon learning of the coercive acts, many Americans agreed with the sentiments expressed by the people of Farmington, Connecticut.
The present ministry, being instigated by the devil and led on by their wicked and corrupt hearts, have a design to take away our liberties and properties and to enslave us forever. Those pimps and parasites should be held in utter abhorrence by us and every American, and their names loaded with the curses of all succeeding generations. We scorn the chains of slavery. We despise every attempt to rivet them upon us. We are the sons of freedom, and till time shall be no more, godlike virtue shall blazon our hemisphere.
Americans responded to the coercive acts by calling the First Continental Congress. On September 5, 1774, 56 delegates from 12 colonies convened in Philadelphia. For nearly 2 months, this assembly debated appropriate action against Britain. Radicals and conservatives, and delegates who embodied both positions, attended the Congress. Many years later, John Adams described the delegates.
America is in total ignorance, or under infinite deception, concerning that assembly. To draw the character of them would require a volume, and would be considered as a caricature print. One-third were Tories, another Whigs, and the rest mongrels.
The differences among delegates were also noted by Joseph Galloway, a conservative Pennsylvania delegate who would remain loyal to Britain during the war.
Upon the meeting of Congress, two parties were immediately formed, with different views, and determined to act upon different principles.
In addition to Galloway, the Conservative Party included New York's James Duane and John Jay, Delaware's John Dickinson, and South Carolina's John Rutledge. Galloway described this group sympathetically.
One party intended candidly and clearly to define American rights, and explicitly and dutifully to petition for the remedy which would redress the grievances justly complained of, to form a more solid and constitutional union between the two countries, and to avoid every measure which tended to sedition or acts of violent opposition.
The Radical Party included Massachusetts' Sam Adams and John Adams, Virginia's Richard Henry Lee and Patrick Henry, and South Carolina's Christopher Gadsden. Galloway's account of this group was unsympathetic, but revealing.
The other party consisted of persons whose design from the beginning of their opposition to the Stamp Act was to overthrow all subordination and connection with Great Britain, who meant by every fiction, falsehood, and fraud to delude the people from their due allegiance, to throw the subsisting governments into anarchy, to incite the ignorant and vulgar to arms, and with those arms, to establish American independence.
Radicals wanted Congress to respond to the coercive acts with quick, decisive measures. Conservatives wanted to forestall drastic measures until reconciliation with Britain could be achieved. The radical John Adams became disgusted with time-consuming committees and debates.
The business of the Congress is tedious beyond expression. This assembly is like no other that ever existed. Every man in it is a great man, an orator, a critic, a statesman. And therefore every man upon every question must show his oratory, his criticism, and his political abilities. The consequence of this is that business is drawn and spun out to an immeasurable length. I believe if it was moved and seconded that we should come to a resolution that 3 and 2 make 5, we should be entertained with logic and rhetoric, law, history, politics, and mathematics, and then we should pass the resolution unanimously in the affirmative.
On the whole, the first Congress was a victory for the radicals. It endorsed the strident Suffolk resolves, which had been drafted in Massachusetts by Joseph Warren and then rushed to Philadelphia by Paul Revere on one of his famous rides. The Suffolk resolves called for open defiance of the coercive acts and for tax monies to be withheld. These resolves also called for the appointment of new officers to the Massachusetts militia, who were to drill their units once a week. One of the most important papers issued by this Congress was entitled Declarations and Resolves. This comprehensive resume of colonial rights and grievances reflected a number of compromises between radicals and conservatives. Radicals wanted to state American rights as rights of nature grounded in natural law. Richard Henry Lee called this the broadest bottom, the ground of nature. But to present American rights as natural rights rather than as the rights of Englishmen carried revolutionary implications, and delegates knew it. This approach suggested America was in a state of nature relative to Britain, or in other words, that America was no longer bound by the British Constitution. Patrick Henry declared,
"Government is dissolved. Fleets and armies and the present state of things show that government is dissolved. We are in a state of nature."
This virtual decree of American independence was opposed by conservative delegates. They wanted American rights to be presented as the traditional rights of Englishmen because this would announce America's desire to remain under British rule. Only with this conciliatory approach, they maintained, would Parliament listen to American grievances. The conservative James Duane argued,
"Upon the whole, I am for grounding our rights on the laws and constitution of the country from whence we sprung, and charters, without recurring to the laws of nature, because this will be a feeble support."
Delegates compromised. The declaration and resolves included both sides.
"We declare that the inhabitants of the English colonies in North America, by the immutable laws of nature, the principles of the English Constitution, and the several charters and compacts, have the following rights. They are entitled to life, liberty, and property, and they have never ceded to any sovereign power whatever a right to dispose of either without their consent."
The First Congress presented its strategy against the coercive acts in a plan known as the Continental Association. The association called for extensive economic sanctions against Britain and the British West Indies, including non-importation, non-consumption, and non-exportation. Of course, these measures would cause shortages in America, so Congress called for a general price freeze. To enforce this association, Congress recommended that committees be established in every county, city, and town. These committees of safety, as they came to be known, were to search out violators, make their names known to the public, and condemn them as enemies of American liberty. Conservatives attacked the committees of safety as tyrannical cliques. A New Jersey writer exclaimed,
"Had an act of Parliament formed such an inquisition by giving power to any man or set of men to observe the conduct of their fellow subjects, and as a majority should determine, their neighbors should be exposed to insult and contempt at their pleasure, how should we have heard of the liberty of the subject, his right to trial by his peers, etc., etc.? Yet those men, at the same time they arraign the highest authority on earth, insolently trample on the liberties of their fellow subjects, and, without the shadow of a trial, take from them their property, grant it to others, and, not content with all this, hold them up to contempt, and expose them to the vilest injuries."
A writer from Pennsylvania defended the association. The only penalty prescribed by Congress, he pointed out, was the penalty of public opinion.
"The Congress, like other legislative bodies, have annexed penalties to their laws. They do not consist of the gallows, the rack, and the stake. These punishments are proper only for a corrupted people. The Congress have held out no punishments but infamy. A species of infamy which sound more dreadful to a freeman than the gallows, the rack, or the stake. It is this: he shall be declared in the public papers to be an enemy to his country."
Technically, this writer was correct. Congress had recommended nonviolent sanctions against violators of the association. In practice, however, violence was often used against Americans who refused to support the resistance movement. Tarring and feathering was the preferred treatment for recalcitrants, as indicated in this recommendation.
The following is the recipe for an effectual operation. First, strip a person naked. Then heat the tar until it is thin and pour it upon the naked flesh, or rub it over with a tar brush. After which, sprinkle decently upon the tar, whilst it is yet warm, as many feathers as will stick to it. Then hold a lighted candle to the feathers, and try to set it all on fire. If it will burn, so much the better. But as the experiment is often made in cold weather, it will not then succeed. Take also an halter, and put it round the person's neck, and then cart him the rounds.
Tarring and feathering, which could cause massive infections, was sometimes followed by another American favorite, riding the rail. These grand Tory rides, as they were called, consisted of having a victim carried roughly on a sharp rail, which he straddled between his legs. In May 1774, General Gage arrived in Boston to assume his new role as governor of Massachusetts. His job was to close the port of Boston and to enforce other provisions of the coercive acts. By the end of 1774, Gage had around 3,500 soldiers in or near Boston. One of these soldiers, an officer, wrote a letter home telling what he thought of the people of Massachusetts.
"With the most austere show of devotion, they are void of every principle of religion or common honesty, and reckoned the most arrant cheats and hypocrites upon the whole continent of America."
This officer, like many of his colleagues, derisively dismissed the military threat posed by these Americans.
"As to what you hear of their taking arms to resist the force of England, it is mere bullying, and will go no farther than words. Whenever it comes to blows, he that can run fastest will think himself best off. Believe me, any two regiments here ought to be decimated if they did not beat, in the field, the whole force of the Massachusetts province. For though they are numerous, they are but a mere mob, without order or discipline, and very awkward at handling their arms."
General Gage believed New England was in a state of rebellion, and he so informed the home government. After reading Gage's letters, King George declared,
I am not sorry that the line of conduct seems chalked out. The New England governments are in a state of rebellion. Blows must decide whether they are to be subject to this country or independent.
On January 27, 1775, Lord Dartmouth, Secretary of State for the Colonies, wrote a fateful dispatch to General Gage. This letter began,
"The violences committed by those who have taken up arms in Massachusetts have appeared to me as the acts of a rude rabble, without plan, without concert, without conduct. And therefore, I think that a small force now, if put to the test, would be able to conquer them, with greater probability of success than might be expected from a larger army."
Shortly after receiving these instructions, General Gage decided on a course of action. He decided to capture military supplies stored at Concord. On the night of April 18th, 700 British soldiers set out for Concord, some 16 miles from Boston. About 4:30 on the morning of the 19th, British soldiers under the command of Major Pitcairn entered the small town of Lexington. Forewarned of the British march, 70 militiamen had drawn up in two ragged columns. The Americans were led by Jonas Parker, a veteran of the French and Indian Wars. It's not clear what Parker hoped to accomplish by taking a stand in Lexington, for his 70 militiamen were outgunned by Pitcairn. Nonetheless, Parker told his militiamen,
"Stand your ground! Don't fire unless fired upon! But if they want to have a war, let it begin here."
Major Pitcairn ordered the Americans to lay down their arms and disperse. Parker told his men to disband, but as they did so, they took their muskets with them. Major Pitcairn repeated his order.
"Lay down your arms! Damn you! Why don't you lay down your arms?"
A British officer cried out, "Damn them! We will have them," meaning the rebels' muskets. Someone fired a shot. The shot heard round the world. Then a British officer yelled, "Fire, by God! Fire!" One platoon fired, but the shots went high. Major Pitcairn frantically signaled a ceasefire, but in vain. Another volley tore through the retreating American ranks, followed by a bayonet charge. 8 Americans lay dead on Lexington Green, including Jonas Parker. 10 more were wounded. The British reformed their ranks, gave a great victory cheer, and proceeded on the road to Concord. When the British reached Concord, they encountered hundreds of militiamen who had swarmed in from surrounding counties. More fighting occurred, but real disaster awaited the British on their march home. The road to Boston became a gauntlet of death, as Americans sniped from behind houses, barns, walls, rocks, and trees. When the sun set on August 19, 1775, the British had suffered 273 casualties, the Americans 93. News of Lexington and Concord provoked a sharp reaction among Americans. New England farmers shouldered their muskets, bade farewell to their families, and joined militia units which were laying siege to the British garrison on the Boston Peninsula. Except for minor skirmishes, the siege of Boston was an uneventful stalemate during its first 2 months. The Americans, more than 10,000 strong, were loosely organized and poorly equipped. They were in no shape to launch an offensive. The American commander, Artemus Ward, wished only to hem in the British, thereby buying precious time to accumulate ammunition and cannon. Meanwhile, the British commander, General Gage, was equally unenthusiastic about launching an offensive. With fewer than 5,000 regulars, Gage had requested reinforcements from Britain. He decided to sit tight until they arrived. Gage received few reinforcements, but he got a boatload of advice. On May 26, the British frigate Cerberus sailed into Boston Harbor. Aboard were 3 major generals sent to advise Gage: William Howe, who would shortly replace Gage as British commander, Henry Clinton, who would later replace Howe, and the flamboyant John Burgoyne, Gentleman Johnny, wit, playwright, and man of fashion. Burgoyne described himself and his 2 colleagues as a triumvirate of reputation. The triumvirate would survive the American War, but the reputations would not. Gage's advisers prodded him into action. He issued a proclamation which declared martial law, condemned the rebels, and offered to pardon all who affirmed their allegiance to Britain, with the exception of John Hancock and Sam Adams. Gage's florid, bombastic proclamation had been written by General Burgoyne. it was ill-suited to win the hearts and minds of Americans. This passage is typical.
The authors of the present unnatural revolt have uniformly placed their chief confidence in the suppression of truth, and the grossest forgeries, calumnies, and absurdities that ever insulted human understanding have been imposed upon the people's credulity. The press has been invariably prostituted. The animated language of ancient and virtuous times has been applied to countenance the most abandoned violation of those sacred blessings, till to complete the horrid profanation of terms and ideas, the name of God has been introduced in the pulpits to excite and justify devastation and massacre.
Some Americans were amused by this purple prose. Others loaded their pens with vitriol and fired back at Gage. The Reverend John Cleveland declared,
"Thou profane, wicked monster of falsehood and perfidy, your late infamous proclamation is as full of notorious lies as a toad or rattlesnake of deadly poison. Without speedy repentance, you will have an aggravated damnation in hell. You are not only a robber, a murderer and usurper, but a wicked rebel. A rebel against the authority of truth, law, equity, the English constitution of government, these colony states, and humanity itself."
As the siege of Boston wore on, British supplies ran short. Troop rations were cut back, British morale flagged. A Boston loyalist, Peter Oliver, described the scene for his brother in England.
"Our situation here, without any exaggeration, is beyond description, almost. It is such as eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor hath it ever entered into the heart of man to conceive Boston ever to arrive at. We are besieged this moment with 10,000 or 15,000 men, from Roxbury to Cambridge, their rebel sentries within call of the troop sentries on the neck. We are every hour expecting an attack by land or water. All marketing from the country has stopped. Fire and slaughter hourly threatened. And not out of danger from some of the inhabitants within of setting the town on fire."
The sight of well-trained British regulars hemmed in by undisciplined colonials was too much for some British officers to bear. Upon entering Boston Harbor, Burgoyne declared,
"What? 10,000 peasants keep 5,000 of the king's troops shut up? Well, let us in, and we'll soon find elbow room."
Generals Howe, Clinton, and Burgoyne urged the cautious Gage to undertake a limited offensive. Boston was vulnerable to artillery bombardment from Dorchester Heights, hilly ground southeast of Boston. The British decided to seize and fortify Dorchester Heights before Americans used it to rain cannonballs on their positions. British plans leaked to the Americans, who decided to fortify another strategic high ground, Bunker Hill, the highest of three principal elevations on the Charlestown Peninsula north of Boston. On June 16th, New England militia gathered under the elms of the Cambridge Common. An eyewitness described this assemblage of over 1,000 men.
"To a man, they wore small clothes, coming down and fastening just below the knee, and long stockings with cowhide shoes ornamented by large buckles, while not a pair of boots graced the company. The coats and waistcoats were loose and of huge dimensions, with colors as various as the barks of oak, sumac, and other trees of our hills and swamps could make them, and theirs were all made of flax, and like every other part of the dress were homespun. On their heads was worn a large, round top and broad-rimmed hat. Their arms were as various as their costume. Here an old soldier carried a heavy queen's arm with which he had done service at the conquest of Canada 20 years previous, while by his side walked a stripling boy with a Spanish fusee not half its weight or caliber, which his grandfather may have taken at the Havana, while not a few had old French pieces that dated back to the reduction of Louisbourg. Instead of the cartridge box, a large powder horn was slung under the arm, and occasionally a bayonet might be seen bristling in the ranks. Some of the swords of the officers had been made by our province blacksmiths, perhaps from some farming utensil. They looked serviceable, but heavy and uncouth.
At about 9 p.m., Colonel William Prescott led the New Englanders to the narrow neck of Charlestown Peninsula. Here, for the first time, Prescott informed his officers of their mission to fortify Bunker Hill. A debate ensued, and for reasons never made clear, it was decided to erect the main works not on Bunker Hill, but on Breed's Hill farther south. Although Bunker Hill was 35 feet higher than Breed's Hill and more easily defended, Breed's Hill lay closer to Boston, just 1/2 mile across the Charles River. About midnight, Americans began their pick-and-shovel work on Breed's Hill. Colonel Gridley, an experienced military engineer, had sketched the lines of a redoubt, a square earthen fort about 6 feet high and 50 yards on each side. The Americans worked feverishly. Only 4 hours separated them from dawn, discovery, and cannonade from British warships anchored nearby. Daybreak revealed the outlines of the redoubt to men aboard the British sloop Lively. It immediately opened fire. Other ships and the artillery battery on Copp's Hill soon joined in. Fortunately for Prescott and his men, most of the cannonballs bounced harmlessly off the earthworks. But the roar of guns terrified many of the inexperienced American soldiers. Some of them left and never returned. Exhausted and thirsty, the men on Breed's Hill had been promised relief by morning. None came. No water, no food, no reinforcements. One young American, Peter Brown, felt betrayed by his officers.
The danger we were in made us think there was treachery, and that we were brought there to be all slain. And I must and will venture to say that there was treachery, oversight, or presumption in the conduct of our officers. And about 5:30 in the morn, we not having above half the fort done, they began to fire. I suppose as soon as they had orders, pretty briskly a few minutes, and then stopped, and then again to the number of about 20 or more. They killed one of us, and then they ceased till about 11 o'clock, and then they began pretty brisk again. And that caused some of our young country people to desert, apprehending the danger in a clearer manner than the rest, who were more diligent in digging and fortifying ourselves against them. We began to be almost beat out, being tired by our labor and having no sleep the night before, but little victuals, no drink but rum.
To reassure his men and keep them working, Colonel Prescott exposed himself to fire by walking atop the unfinished redoubt. Clad in a light linen coat, his bald head glistening with sweat, Prescott shouted encouragement and orders. When a cannonball finally killed one man working outside the redoubt, Prescott was asked what should be done. "Bury him," was his terse reply. While Prescott's men rushed to complete their redoubt, the British generals assessed the weak American position. British ships controlled the water which nearly surrounded Charlestown Peninsula, and these ships could blast the only route for American reinforcement, supply, and retreat, a narrow neck connecting Charlestown Peninsula to the mainland. In addition, the American left side was undefended, allowing the British to march up the east side of the Mystic River, safely beyond the range of American musket fire. From there, part of the British force could outflank the redoubt and attack it from the rear, while other British soldiers executed a frontal assault. This became the British plan of attack. General Howe was the British field commander. He lost precious hours waiting for high tide so he could land his 28 barges containing 1,500 soldiers on the southeastern shore of Charlestown Peninsula. When Howe completed his amphibious landing at 1 in the afternoon, he realized the Americans had been greatly reinforced. Moreover, a breastwork extending from the redoubt now protected the American left, thereby rendering a British flanking movement more difficult. Howe decided to wait for 700 reserves. General Howe hoped to turn the American left flank by overrunning a low stone wall on the beach. For this he would use 11 companies of light infantry, the elite among British soldiers. After breaking through, these light infantry would attack other fortifications from behind, while grenadiers and regulars attacked from the front. So much for theory. The reality of the battle proved far different and far bloodier. Howe assumed the Americans defending the beach would fire one inaccurate volley, perhaps two at most. Then, before they could reload, the light infantry's bayonets would cut them to pieces. This never happened. General Howe greatly underestimated the skill of the beach's defenders, Colonel Stark's New Hampshire militia. Colonel John Stark positioned his men in three ranks, thus assuring a continuous fire. Excellent marksmen, Stark's men aimed low to compensate for the upward recoil of their muskets. Stark hammered a stake in the sand, 40 yards away, and he told his men, "Not a man is to fire until the first regular crosses that stake." In addition, Stark told his men to look for the distinctive ornaments worn by officers. 50 yards away, the British light infantry leveled their bayonets, let out a roar, and charged. They covered 10 yards before Stark's men fired a withering blast of 1-inch musket balls. The famed Royal Welsh Fusiliers, leading the charge, were decimated. 2/3 of them dropped instantly. As the remaining Fusiliers pushed forward, they met a second blast. Only 6 remained on their feet. Next, the King's Own, a regiment steeped in tradition, surged forward over the dead and wounded. They got only 15 yards before a third volley from Stark's lines tore them apart. Then came the regulars of the 10th Regiment, the soldiers who had fought at Lexington. They, too, charged into a fearsome volley and into another. It was impossible for the light infantry to continue. 350 had attacked. Now 96 dead littered the beach. Colonel Stark's comment was grim, but to the point.
"I never saw sheep lie as thick in the fold."
When General Howe heard the terrible news, he refused to give up. He gave the order, "Attack all along the line." With this command, Howe committed to an unvarnished frontal assault. Howe led the attack on the rail fence, while Pigott led the attack against the redoubt and breastwork. Again, the Americans had been ordered to hold their fire, to aim low, and to target officers, and again, the British soldiers paid an enormous price. Wearing heavy wool uniforms on a hot, humid day, and lugging over 100 pounds of equipment on their backs, British soldiers tried to overrun strongly fortified positions. They never got close. As front ranks were felled by American fire, they collapsed into the ranks behind them. Finally, mercifully, a retreat was ordered. And so ended the first phase of the Battle of Bunker Hill. General Howe launched a second attack within 15 minutes. The battle plan differed from the first attack, but the results were similar. An English soldier described the fighting.
"As we approached, an incessant stream of fire poured from the rebel lines. It seemed a continued sheet of fire for near 30 minutes. Our light infantry were served up in companies against the grass fence without being able to penetrate. Indeed, how could we penetrate? Most of our grenadiers and light infantry, the moment of presenting themselves, lost 3/4 and many 9/10 of their men. Some had only 8 and 9 a company left. Some only 3, 4, and 5.
The British retreated a second time. Their losses were staggering. General Howe's officers urged him to stop the slaughter, but Howe was determined not to go down as commander of the most disastrous defeat in British history. He added 400 fresh troops, reformed his lines, and ordered a third attack. This time, he allowed his soldiers to remove their 100-pound packs. Luck was on Howe's side at last. He didn't know it, but the Americans had nearly exhausted their powder. They managed one more deadly volley. Then their fire sputtered out. It was over. The British stormed the redoubt and went to work with their bayonets. The Americans fought back with clubbed muskets and stones. So ended the Battle of Bunker Hill, the bloodiest day of the American Revolution. American losses were about 140 dead, 300 wounded, and 30 captured. British losses were 226 dead and 828 wounded, a casualty rate of over 40%. Officer casualties were especially heavy. Every man in Howe's personal staff was either killed or wounded. Indeed, of all British officer casualties during the Revolution, 1/8 were killed and an additional 1/6 were wounded during the Battle of Bunker Hill. Shortly after the battle, one British officer blamed the dreadful loss on General Howe and his frontal attack.
"We are all wrong at the head. My mind cannot help dwelling upon our cursed mistakes. Such ill conduct at the first outset argues a gross ignorance of the most common rules of the profession, and gives us for the future anxious forebodings. I have lost some of those I most valued. This madness of ignorance nothing can excuse. the brave men's lives were wantonly thrown away. Our conductor as much murdered them as if he had cut their throats himself on Boston Common.
Technically, the British had won. But as General Howe said, the success is too dearly bought. General Clinton agreed. A few more such victories, he wrote, would have shortly put an end to British dominion in America. General Johnny Burgoyne, on the other hand, called it a day of glory. On July 2, 1776, the Second Continental Congress proclaimed American independence. One war and many thousands of lives later, that independence became a reality. But the cost had been high. After the Battle of Bunker Hill, Benjamin Franklin wrote to a British politician and longtime friend,
"You are a member of Parliament, and one of that majority which has doomed my country to destruction. You have begun to burn our towns and murder our people. Look at your hands. They are stained with the blood of your relations. You and I were long friends. You are now my enemy. And I am yours."
The American Revolution was a war for independence, but it was more than that. It was also a civil war, in which American rebels fought American loyalists. Estimates vary, but possibly as many as a third of Americans remained loyal to the British crown. In the middle colonies, such as Pennsylvania and New York, loyalists may have comprised half of the population. These loyalists often fought with the British against the rebels. The loyalist John Peters recounted one such battle.
"The rebels pushed with a strong party on the front of the loyalists, where I commanded. As they were coming up, I observed a man fire at me, which I returned. He loaded again as he came up, and discharged again at me, and crying out, 'Peters, you damned Tory, I have got you,' he rushed on me with his bayonet, which entered just below my left breast, but was turned by the bone. By this time I was loaded, and I saw that it was a rebel captain, and old schoolfellow and playmate, and a cousin of my wife's. Though his bayonet was in my body, I felt regret at being obliged to destroy him."
Whether viewed as a war for independence or as a civil war, the American Revolution was played out against the background of 18th century warfare with all its assumptions and attitudes. The 18th century is called the Age of Civilized Warfare because, in theory at least, wars were restricted to professional military men who followed formal rules of engagement. Let's take a look at this civilized warfare, especially as employed by the British. 18th century wars were usually clashes between dynastic nation-states. Dubbed the sport of kings, these wars were fought to maintain the balance of power in Europe. Civilians might not even know their country was at war, unless an army happened their way. And when a battle did occur, civilians sometimes packed picnic baskets and observed the spectacle from a nearby hill. Nationalism did not become a crucial factor in warfare until the French Revolution of 1789. Before then, wars were fought between governments, not between peoples. Thus, it was quite acceptable for 18th century civilians to visit an enemy's country during wartime. In April 1775, America had no professional army, whereas Britain's army numbered over 48,000 men, and Britain, unlike America, was a formidable naval power. But England had more money than cannon fodder, so she hired 30,000 German mercenaries to help crush the American rebellion. 18th century Germany was a conglomeration of principalities. Her mercenaries were usually called Hessians, because the largest contingent came from the principality of Hesse-Cassel. The British and German soldiers were professionals, trained in the art of 18th century warfare. Common soldiers hailed from the lowest rungs of European society, vagabonds, ne'er-do-wells, and criminals. These men were usually conscripted. Transforming them into professional soldiers took from 3 to 5 years. This represented a considerable financial investment, so military campaigns were designed to minimize loss of life. Daniel Defoe, author of Robinson Crusoe, put it cleverly,
"The present maxims of war are, never fight without a manifest advantage, and always encamp so as not to be forced to it. And if two opposite generals nicely observe both these rules, it is impossible that they should come to fight."
Unlike common soldiers, officers were drawn from the aristocracy and gentry. Because of their similar backgrounds, officers of opposing armies identified more with each other than with the men they commanded. This may account for much of the so-called civility in 18th-century warfare, a civility that rarely extended down the ranks. If two armies engaged, commanders preferred to maneuver for strategic positions rather than slug it out in open combat. When battles did occur, they were bloody. Soldiers stood side by side in several rows, faced the enemy at close range on open ground, and exchanged volleys of musket fire. Of course, human beings are reluctant to serve as stand-up targets for sheets of musket fire. Therefore, severe discipline and rigorous drilling conditioned the common soldier to obey without question. Soldiers were supposed to be automatons, parts of a machine, not thinking individuals. A master of warfare, Prussia's Frederick the Great, put it well. "If my soldiers began to think," he said, "not one would remain in the ranks." To keep soldiers in the ranks, Frederick offered this advice.
"If a soldier, during an action, looks about, as if to flee, or so much as sets foot outside the line, the non-commissioned officer standing behind him will run him through with his bayonet and kill him on the spot."
Officers were permitted to resign, but when common soldiers tried to resign, as they frequently did, it was called desertion. Thus, scattered movements, such as pursuing a routed enemy, were frowned upon, because many soldiers would never return. Nor, for the same reason, were soldiers permitted to wander the countryside in search of supplies. Consequently, armies had to maintain supply depots, baggage wagons, and supply lines. A rule of thumb was never to move an army more than 5 miles beyond the nearest base of supplies. In addition, high-ranking officers didn't want war to crimp their lifestyles, so they carried wagon loads of china, finery, and other aristocratic necessities, not to mention a sufficient number of servants and mistresses. Little wonder, then, that 18th-century armies crawled at a snail's pace. The standard firearm of the British Army was the Brown Bess, a smoothbore flintlock musket. These muskets were notoriously inaccurate. Their effective range was around 50 yards, and a competent infantryman could fire 3 or 4 rounds per minute. British soldiers didn't even try to aim, they simply leveled their muskets and fired in unison. The British were not renowned for marksmanship, but their bayonet attacks were fearsome to behold. Bayonets were especially effective during rainstorms when drenched powder disabled muskets. They were also vital to night battles when it was hard to distinguish friend from foe at a distance. British prowess with bayonets contributed to many victories over the Americans. A French officer serving with the American army commented,
"The principal advantage of General Howe's army over General Washington's must be ascribed to their being more trained to the use of the bayonet. The American army knows their superior dexterity in firing well, and rely entirely upon it. The British army know it likewise and dread it. Hence, in all engagements, the British soldiers rush on with the bayonet after one fire, and seldom fail of throwing the Americans into confusion."
Fear of British bayonet attacks led the American army to rely more on muskets than on rifles. Rifles, unlike smoothbore muskets, have grooved barrels that cause bullets to spin. This stabilizes their trajectory and makes rifles highly accurate. But 18th-century rifles had disadvantages. They could not accommodate bayonets, they tended to foul in bad weather, and they required a good deal of practice to master. Moreover, a rifle ball had to be jammed tightly down the barrel, and this took time. In a minute, a musket could be reloaded 3 or 4 times, whereas a rifle could be reloaded only once. American riflemen would sometimes fire one shot, only to find the bayonet-wielding enemy at their throats before they could reload. George Washington criticized riflemen because many were unruly frontiersmen who refused to conform to the rigors of army discipline. but these frontiersmen who were accurate at 200 yards or more were a terror to their favorite targets, enemy officers. To British and Hessian officers schooled in European warfare, this sniping was barbaric, and it earned riflemen the nickname of epaulette men, after the ornament worn on the shoulders of the officers they targeted. One Hessian officer reported,
"Today we cut the aiguillettes from our uniforms and the stripes from our hats. This was ordered so that we could not be distinguished from the common soldiers."
As the American Revolution erupted, America had no professional army, or standing army, to use the 18th century term. Instead, the 13 colonies relied on citizen militias for their defense. Militia systems varied from colony to colony. Generally speaking, men from the age of 16 to 60 were required to drill regularly and, if needed, to serve short-term enlistments, often from 6 to 12 months. By the close of the Seven Years' War in 1763, known in America as the French and Indian War, many British berated the fighting ability of Americans. The militia had fought well when defending their homes, but they had been less enthusiastic about helping the British wrest Canada from the French. In 1758, during the Siege of Louisbourg, the British commander James Wolfe wrote,
"The Americans are in general the dirtiest, the most contemptible, cowardly dogs that you can conceive. There is no depending upon them in action. They fall down dead in their own dirt and desert by battalions, officers and all."
George Washington, who had fought with the British during the Seven Years' War, also held the American militia in low esteem. Washington took command of the New England militias after the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he brought the perspective of a Virginia aristocrat to his new job as commander-in-chief. Washington didn't like the New England militias, or for that matter, New Englanders themselves. In 1775, Washington wrote to his brother,
"Their officers, generally speaking, are the most indifferent kind of people I ever saw. They are by no means such troops in any respects as you are led to believe of them from the accounts which are published, but I need not make myself enemies among them by this declaration, although it is consistent with truth. I dare say the men would fight very well if properly officered, although they are an exceedingly dirty and nasty people."
Some colonial militias were remarkably democratic. The soldiers elected their officers, and everyone received the same pay. Private Aaron Wright of a Pennsylvania rifle company left this account.
June 29, 1775. We were sworn to be true and faithful soldiers in the Continental Army, under direction of the Right Honorable Congress. After that, we chose our officers. When on parade, our first lieutenant came and told us he would be glad if we would excuse him from going, which we refused, and, on consideration, we concluded it was better to consent, after which he said he would go. But we said, "You shall not command us, for he whose mind can change in an hour is not fit to command in a field where liberty is contended for." In the evening, we chose a private in his place.
George Washington was appalled by this practice. He wanted to model the Continental Army after conventional European armies, and for the most part, he got his way. The militia, Washington argued, could not defeat well-trained, professional armies.
"To place any dependence on the militia is assuredly resting upon a broken staff. Men just dragged from the tender scenes of domestic life, unaccustomed to the din of arms, totally unacquainted with every kind of military skill, when opposed by troops regularly trained, disciplined, and appointed, makes them timid and ready to fly at their own shadows. Besides, the sudden change in their manner of living, particularly lodging, brings on sickness in many."
Typically, militiamen enlisted for short periods of time, after which they returned to their farms to tend crops. The average militiaman saw little point in defending his home if his family starved in the process. But short enlistments did not provide enough time to train soldiers in the style of 18th century European warfare, again quoting Washington.
"Men accustomed to unbounded freedom cannot brook restraint, which is absolutely necessary to the good order and government of the army, without which licentiousness and every kind of disorder triumphantly reign. To bring men to a proper degree of subordination is not the work of a day a month, or even a year.
In the British Army, discipline was severe. Soldiers received hundreds of lashes for minor offenses, and 1,000 or more for major ones. During the early stages of the Revolution, punishment in the American Army was limited to the Old Testament prescription of 39 lashes. Washington regarded this as woefully inadequate. He wanted a maximum of 500 lashes. But Congress recognized the awkward implications of whipping free men, so it refused Washington's request. Congress, however, did raise the limit to 100 lashes, and later in the war, to 200 lashes. General Charles Lee, a former British officer with considerable military experience, served as America's third in command. Unlike Washington, Lee believed the militia system could be adapted to fight a European army.
It is certain that a militia, by confining themselves to essentials, by a simplification of the necessary maneuvers, may become, in a very few months, a most formidable infantry. The yeomanry of America have, besides infinite advantages over the peasantry of other countries, they are accustomed from their infancy to firearms. They are expert in the use of them. The Americans are, likewise, to a man skillful in the management of the instruments necessary for all military works, such as spades, pickaxes, hatchets, etc. As to the idea that the Americans are deficient in courage, it is too ridiculous and glaringly false to deserve a refutation.
In Lee's opinion, it was absurd for Americans to challenge the British in open combat. Instead, Americans should fight an irregular war, or guerrilla war, as it's called today.
To say that the Americans are so equal to the British in disciplined officers, and even ardor or numbers, as that a decisive action in fair ground may be risked, is talking nonsense. To try the experiment would be insanity. A plan of defense, harassing, and impeding can alone succeed.
European battles were fought by conventional rules, that is, by disciplined soldiers in tight lines and with considerable space to maneuver. But this style of warfare was ill-suited to the dense wilderness of North America, where colonists had faced and learned from a formidable enemy, the American Indian. Indians were superb fighters, highly skilled in the arts of ambush, hit-and-run raids, and fighting from behind cover. Henry Bouquet, a veteran British commander who had been stationed in America, summarized the Indians' guerrilla tactics.
It may be taken for granted, first, that their general maxim is to surround their enemy. Second, that they fight in extended order and never in a compact body. Third, that when attacked, they never stand their ground, but immediately give way to return the charge when the attack ceases.
As it turned out, Americans used both conventional and irregular methods of warfare. The American Revolution, unlike European wars, was not fought according to military manuals. American rebels cared little for conventional rules and nothing at all for the balance of power. They were fighting for their very existence as a free people. Washington and other Americans learned and adapted as they went along. This flexibility contributed greatly to the American victory. Ultimately, most casualties, American and British alike, were not caused by weapons or by mistaken strategies. The worst killer was disease, the curse of all 18th century armies. Early in the Revolution, the Americans had launched a disastrous offensive against Canada, losing thousands of men to the ravages of smallpox. Smallpox, wrote John Adams, was 10 times more terrible than Britons, Canadians, and Indians together. A participant in the ill-fated Canadian expedition noted in his journal,
Tuesday the 4th. One of our regiment died this morning very suddenly, and was interred without so much as a coffin, and with little or no ceremony. Among hundreds of men, it was difficult to procure 8 or 10 to bear the corpse about 15 rods. Monday, the 10th. Nothing to be heard from morning to night but doctor, 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 from every side till one is deaf, dumb, and blind, and almost dead. Wednesday, the 26th. The regiment is in a most deplorable situation. Between 400 and 500 now in the height of the smallpox. Death is now become a daily visitant in the camps, but as little regarded as the singing of birds.
On July 2nd, 1776, the day Congress voted for independence, British troops under the command of General William Howe landed on Staten Island. 10 days later, a battle fleet carrying reinforcements arrived from Britain under the command of General Howe's brother, Admiral Richard Howe. The total British and Hessian forces assembled around New York reached 32,000 soldiers, 10,000 seamen, 400 transports, 30 warships, and mountains of equipment. In late August, 15,000 of these British troops landed at Gravesend Bay on Long Island. 5,000 assaulted the main American force, while 10,000 marched around the American left flank. The Americans suffered a crushing defeat, losing 1,500 men who were either killed, wounded, or captured. For many Americans, this was the first taste of battle. A soldier described his reaction.
The horrors of battle there presented themselves to my mind in all their hideousness. I must come to it now, thought I. Well, I will endeavor to do my duty as well as I'm able, and leave the event with Providence. We now began to meet the wounded men, another sight I was unacquainted with, some with broken legs, and some with broken heads. The sight of these a little daunted me and made me think of home, but the sight and thought vanished together.
A British officer wrote a letter about the battle for Long Island.
Rejoice, my friend, that we have given the rebels a damned crush. We flanked and overpowered them with numbers. The Hessians and our brave Highlanders gave no quarters, and it was a fine sight to see with what alacrity they dispatched the rebels with their bayonets after we had surrounded them so that they could not resist. Multitudes were drowned and suffocated in morasses, a proper punishment for all rebels. We took care to tell the Hessians that the rebels had resolved to give no quarters to them in particular, which made them fight desperately and put all to death that fell into their hands. You know all stratagems are lawful in war, especially against such vile enemies to their king and country.
After losing the Battle of Long Island, George Washington withdrew his army to New York City, which then occupied only the southern tip of Manhattan Island. These American soldiers were in miserable shape. An English traveler, Nicholas Cresswell, described their condition.
The troops stationed here are Yankee men, the nastiest devils in creation. It would be impossible for any human creature whose organs of smelling was more delicate than that of a hog to live one day under the lee of this camp. Such a complication of stinks. I saw a Yankee put a pint of molasses into about a gallon of mutton broth. The army here is numerous, but ragged, dirty, sickly, and ill-disciplined. If my countrymen are beaten by these ragamuffins, I shall be much surprised.
American morale was low, and as Washington reported, thousands of militiamen left for home.
The militia, instead of calling forth their utmost efforts in order to repair our losses, are dismayed, intractable, and impatient to return. Great numbers of them have gone off, in some instances, almost by whole regiments, by half ones, and by companies at a time.
New York City could not be defended against the British Army and Navy. General Nathaniel Greene urged Washington to burn the city and abandon Manhattan. But Congress feared the political repercussions should an American army burn an American city, and it urged General Washington to mount a defense. Washington tried to defend Manhattan Island by stringing out his army over a length of 16 miles. A British assault on the center of this line would split the army in two and isolate the forces in New York City. Washington reconsidered and decided to evacuate New York City. On September 14th, he wrote to Congress.
We are now taking every method in our power to remove the stores and cannon, in which we find almost insuperable difficulties. They are so great and so numerous that I fear we shall not effect the whole before we shall meet with some interruption.
Washington's fears were well founded. 4,000 British and Hessians overran the weak American defense at Kipps Bay, midway between New York City and Harlem Heights. Militiamen flung down their muskets and knapsacks and ran in terror. Around 400 Americans were lost in the debacle, most of them captured. The American soldiers remaining in New York City were in danger of being cut off. They fled hurriedly, leaving behind valuable cannon and other military equipment. The American army regrouped in the wooded countryside of northern Manhattan. On paper, Washington had 25,000 men under his command, but he listed the number actually present and fit for duty at 16,124. The Americans were tired, dispirited, and hungry. But on September 16th, they won a stand-up fight against British regulars at Harlem Heights. This was a minor engagement, but it boosted American morale. Colonel Joseph Reed reported,
"You can hardly conceive the change it has made in our army. The men have recovered their spirits and feel a confidence which before they had quite lost. I hope the effects will be lasting."
Washington's army was poorly supplied, so many soldiers plundered the surrounding countryside. This undermined popular support for the rebel cause, and Washington was worried.
"Such a spirit has gone forth that neither public nor private property is secure. Every hour brings the most distressing complaints of the ravages of our own troops, who are become infinitely more formidable to the poor farmers and inhabitants than the common enemy. The baggage of officers and the hospital stores, even the quarters of the general officers, are not exempt from rapine."
Meanwhile, the British had occupied New York City, much to the delight of the many loyalists there. The cautious General Howe dawdled in New York for a month before resuming the offensive. Then he landed troops north of Harlem Heights in an effort to trap the American army on Manhattan Island. Washington avoided the trap by moving northward, off Manhattan Island, to the high ground of White Plains, New York. On October 28th, British and American forces clashed at White Plains. The Americans gave up the hill and fled northward. But General Howe and his 20,000 men did not pursue. Instead, they turned southward to exploit an error made by Washington, an error which would cost the Americans dearly. When Washington abandoned Manhattan, he left behind nearly 3,000 men in Fort Washington, an earthen fortress situated on craggy rocks high above the Hudson River. Across from Fort Washington, on the Jersey side of the Hudson River, there was another fort, Fort Lee. In theory, these forts were supposed to hinder the passage of British ships along the Hudson, but in practice, they had proved unable to do so. Washington was nervous about leaving a large contingent of men behind British lines, but General Nathanael Greene convinced him that Fort Washington could and should be defended. Washington agreed, and so committed his greatest blunder of the war. Howe's army swept the outer defenses of Fort Washington and captured it, along with 2,800 men and a large quantity of materiel. A British officer described the American prisoners.
"The rebel prisoners were, in general, but very indifferently clothed. Few of them appeared to have a second shirt, nor did they appear to have washed themselves during the campaign. A great many of them were lads under 15 and old men, and few had the appearance of soldiers. Their odd figures frequently excited the laughter of our soldiers."
After the fall of Fort Washington, the Americans abandoned Fort Lee in haste, leaving behind more precious equipment. The loss of these forts was a staggering setback. General Nathanael Greene, who had argued for the defense of Fort Washington, was despondent.
"I feel mad, vexed, sick, and sorry. Never did I need the consoling voice of a friend more than now. This is a most terrible event. Its consequences are justly to be dreaded."
After the British had captured Manhattan Island, Washington feared they would invade New England. To guard against this possibility, he divided his already weak army into three parts. Two of these parts, some 8,700 men, were left on the east side of the Hudson River. Then Washington crossed the Hudson, where he had a third contingent, 5,400 men, under his direct command. New Englanders comprised a large portion of the rebel army, and many were anxious to return to their farms. Lacking shoes and blankets, these soldiers were disheartened by the recent military disasters. A desertion rate of 20% was common in the American army, but now soldiers deserted in droves, a contagion of desertion, as Washington called it. Having crossed to the west side of the Hudson River, Washington and his contingent were pursued by 4,000 British and Hessian soldiers under the command of General Cornwallis. Washington fled southward through New Jersey, hoping to reach the Delaware River before Cornwallis reached him. General Cornwallis boasted he would catch Washington as a hunter bags a fox. But Washington was more of a fox than Cornwallis anticipated. As one British officer explained,
"As we go forward into the country, the rebels fly before us. And when we come back, they always follow us. 'Tis impossible to catch them. They will neither fight nor totally run away. But they keep at such a distance that we are always above a day's march from them. We seem to be playing at bo peep."
On November 30th, 2,000 militiamen from New Jersey and Maryland bade farewell to army life, their enlistments having expired. 11 days later, Washington ferried the remnants of his army across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. Washington feared the British might also cross the Delaware and fall on Philadelphia, the home of the Continental Congress. How could Washington beef up his defenses? Well, there were 5,000 men Washington had left in New York under the command of General Charles Lee. These men were supposed to guard against a British invasion of New England. Should the invasion fail to materialize, Lee was supposed to catch up and join Washington. This was more of a suggestion than an order on Washington's part, because he was in awe of Lee, a former British officer with considerable military experience. Washington held the military ability of Charles Lee in high esteem, an opinion shared by Lee. But Lee was openly contemptuous of Washington's judgment, and he sat tight in New York. After receiving additional requests from Washington, Lee finally crossed the Hudson and entered New Jersey, but he took his time. Lee knew the British, with winter upon them, would not try to capture Philadelphia. Rather than join Washington, Lee believed his forces should harass and disrupt the British supply lines. Lee expressed his frustration with Washington in a letter to the American general Horatio Gates.
"The ingenious maneuver of Fort Washington has unhinged the goodly fabric we had been building. There never was so damned a stroke. Entre nous, a certain great man is most damnably deficient."
Lee penned this letter while staying in a New Jersey inn located 3 miles from his army. That same day, 30 British dragoons descended on the inn and took Lee prisoner. Ironically, his captors were from the same regiment Lee had previously commanded while serving in Portugal. After Lee's capture, General John Sullivan led Lee's army across the Delaware to join Washington. By now, however, Lee's 5,000 men had dwindled to 2,000. Washington received additional reinforcements, and by Christmas time, he estimated his men fit for duty at 6,000. In mid-December, General Howe officially closed the campaign for 1776. He ordered his men into winter quarters, and he established a line of posts stretching across 80 miles. General Howe retired to the comforts of New York, and Mrs. Loring, the blonde, blue-eyed wife of Joshua Loring. Mr. Loring, a New York loyalist, had been appointed to the lucrative job of commissary of prisoners, and he conveniently looked the other way while his wife and William Howe dallied openly. This affair, the talk of England, was commemorated in a popular piece of English doggerel.
"Awake, arouse, Sir Billy. There's forage in the plain. Ah, leave your little filly and open the campaign. Heed not a woman's prattle which tickles in the ear, but give the word for battle, and grasp the warlike spear."
Many inhabitants of New Jersey were either loyal to Britain or neutral. When General Howe proclaimed a full and general pardon for all who would swear allegiance to the crown, 5,000 people signed the pledge. Some signed from conviction, others to protect their property. Howe now faced a delicate political problem endemic to all armies of occupation. He wished to win the hearts and minds of Americans, so he tried to keep his soldiers from exploiting loyal civilians. But officers were unwilling or unable to restrain their men. This was especially true of the Hessians, who pillaged all civilians, friend and foe alike. The loyalist Charles Stedman described the impact of this plundering.
The people of the Jerseys were well affected to His Majesty's government, but when the people found that the promised protection was not afforded them, that their property was seized and most wantonly destroyed, that in many instances their families were insulted, stripped of their beds with other furniture, nay, even of their very wearing apparel, they then determined to try the other side, trusting that they would at least, at one period or other, receive compensation for the supplies taken from them for the use of the American army.
The British and Hessians in New Jersey found themselves fighting an enemy who used guerrilla tactics. In the words of General Charles Lee, the Americans were fighting a people's war. Bands of civilians attacked depots and ammunition dumps, and every civilian was a potential spy. As one Hessian explained,
"It is almost impossible to attack the enemy at any time by surprise, because each house we pass is more or less a lookout. The farmer, his son, or the farmhand either fire her rifle or run along a footpath to inform the enemy."
A Hessian officer, Captain Ewald, told how American women smuggled provisions and equipment underneath their clothes through the Hessian lines, and he warned his men not to talk to civilians.
"This is especially necessary in enemy country, where everybody is against you and tells a lie to bring the enemy upon you. You never get correct information about the enemy. Each step is betrayed at once, and you are soon surrounded from all sides by armed civilians, not a part of the regular army of the enemy, and they are all very good marksmen. One can easily see how difficult reconnoitering can be in this war, because all inhabitants are spies or soldiers."
General Howe responded to guerrilla tactics.
"Small straggling parties, not dressed like soldiers, who presume to molest or fire upon soldiers or peaceable inhabitants of the country, will be immediately hanged without trial as assassins."
Among Washington's virtues as a military commander was his use of spies to gather military intelligence. One of these unsung heroes, John Honeyman, provided Washington with crucial information on the Prussian garrison at Trenton. In addition, Honeyman fed false information to Colonel Rall, the headstrong Prussian commander. The Americans, Honeyman said, were falling apart. They couldn't possibly launch a winter offensive. Rall was put at ease. On December 23rd, when Rall was warned of an impending attack on Trenton, he dismissed it. "This is all idle," Rall declared. "It is woman's talk." Meanwhile, Washington was planning his most brilliant operation of the war, a raid on Trenton. On Christmas night, Washington gathered 2,400 men and 18 cannon on the west bank of an ice-filled Delaware River. Colonel John Fitzgerald recorded the events in his diary.
Christmas, 6 p.m. The regiments have had their evening parade, but instead of returning to their quarters, are marching toward the ferry. It is fearfully cold and raw, and a snowstorm setting in. The wind is northeast and beats in the faces of the men. It will be a terrible night for the soldiers who have no shoes. Some of them have tied old rags around their feet. Others are barefoot. But I have not heard a man complain. They are ready to suffer any hardship and die rather than give up their liberty.
Most Americans have a mental picture of the Delaware crossing based on the famous, though inaccurate, 19th century painting by Emanuel Leutzer. Americans did not use the long boats depicted in this painting. Instead, they used sturdy, flat-bottomed Durham boats, which were normally used to haul grain and iron ore. Nor did Washington stand up with one foot on the gunwale. If he had, America's commander-in-chief would have ended up on the bottom of the Delaware River instead of on the other side. Nevertheless, by the morning of the 26th, the Americans had crossed the Delaware. Washington was among the first to arrive. Colonel Fitzgerald described his demeanor.
December 26th, 3 a.m. I have never seen Washington so determined as he is now. He stands on the bank of the river, wrapped in his cloak, superintending the landing of his troops. He's calm and collected, but very determined. The storm is changing to sleet and cuts like a knife. The last cannon is being landed, and we are ready to mount our horses.
Colonel Rawl had spent a pleasant night playing cards. About midnight, a Loyalist farmer tried to warn Rawl of the Delaware crossing, only to be told by a servant that the colonel was busy. The farmer scribbled a note. When it was given to Rawl, he slipped it into his pocket without reading it and returned to his card game. Washington's men marched on icy roads for 9 miles, arriving at Trenton at 8 a.m. The Hessians were caught off guard. Around 400 escaped, but 106 were killed or wounded, and 868 were captured. No Americans were killed, and only 4 were wounded, including a young officer named James Monroe, a future president of the United States. Washington was not finished with his hit-and-run attacks. He crossed the Delaware again, but this time he nearly lost his entire army. On the evening of January 2nd, 1777, 6,000 British troops pinned the American army against the Delaware River. Fortunately for the Americans, General Cornwallis decided to delay his attack until morning. That night, Washington assigned a special detail of 400 men to keep campfires burning and to clang away with entrenching tools. After creating this illusion of an army digging in, Washington muffled artillery wheels in heavy cloth and escaped with his army along a side road. The Americans marched to Princeton, where they were nearly repulsed by a British bayonet attack. Washington reformed his men, however, and personally led the way. The battle lasted only an hour, but it was fierce. The British lost around 400 men, killed, wounded, or captured. The Americans lost 44. Then the Americans looted Princeton, stealing everything from teapots to Bibles. When furious redcoats reoccupied the village, they also vented their fury on its hapless inhabitants, burning furniture, books, and buildings. According to one observer, Princeton looked as if it had been desolated with the plague and an earthquake. After Trenton and Princeton, British officers could no longer demean the military prowess of George Washington and the American army. A British colonel remarked,
"Though they seem to be ignorant of the precision, order, and even of the principles by which large bodies are moved, yet they possess some of the requisites for making good troops, such as extreme cunning, great industry in moving ground and felling of wood, activity and a spirit of enterprise upon any advantage. Though it was once the fashion of this army to treat them in the most contemptible light, they are now become a formidable enemy."
Trenton and Princeton were modest victories, but they breathed new life into a dying cause. In the words of an English observer, Nicholas Cresswell,
"Volunteer companies are collecting in every county on the continent, and in a few months the rascals will be stronger than ever. Even the parsons, some of them, have turned out as volunteers, summoning all to arms in this cursed Babel. Damn them all!"
General Howe wasted the spring and part of the summer before opening his campaign of 1777. Finally, in July, he set sail from New York with 260 ships and 15,000 men. Howe planned to take Philadelphia, which was in effect America's capital city. After a month at sea, Howe's men disembarked 57 miles from Philadelphia. Washington didn't intend to surrender Philadelphia without a fight. On September 11th, he made his stand on the banks of the Brandywine Creek, midway along Howe's route to Philadelphia. Howe repeated the strategy which had won the Battle of Long Island. He feigned an attack on the American center while he marched the bulk of his army around the American right flank. Again, Washington was outmaneuvered and defeated. Casualties were heavy. The Americans lost over 1,000 men, the British half that number. The Battle of Brandywine was a confusing affair which bore little resemblance to the orderly battles portrayed in stories and paintings. One British officer commented,
"Describe the battle? 'Twas not like those of Covent Garden or Drury Lane. Thou hast seen Le Brun's paintings, and the tapestry, perhaps, at Blenheim. Are these natural resemblances?" "Sure," quoth the captain in a word. "There was a most infernal fire of cannon and musketry, most incessant shouting, 'Incline to the right, incline to the left, halt, charge, etc.,' the balls ploughing up the ground, the trees cracking over one's head, the branches riven by the artillery, the leaves falling as in autumn by the grapeshot."
On September 27th, with bands playing, the British marched into Philadelphia. Most Americans were disheartened, but when the news that Howe had captured Philadelphia reached Benjamin Franklin in Paris, Franklin remarked, "No, Philadelphia has captured Howe." This was an astute observation. In conventional European wars, the conquest of a capital city might signal victory for the conquerors. Not so in America, which was highly decentralized. The occupation of the capital was likely to do little more than tie down the invading army. Before the fall of Philadelphia, Thomas Paine had explored this subject in a series of essays called The American Crisis. Addressing the British, Paine said,
"In all the wars which you have formerly been concerned in, you had only armies to contend with. In this case, you have both an army and a country to combat with. In former wars, the countries followed the fate of their capitals. Canada fell with Quebec, and Minorca with Port Mahon, or St. Philip's. By subduing those, the conquerors opened a way into and became masters of the country. Here it is otherwise. If you get possession of a city here, you are obliged to shut yourselves up in it, and can make no other use of it than to spend your country's money in. A pretty figure you and the Tories would cut in Philadelphia, with a river full of ice and a town full of fire."
When the British occupied Philadelphia, American loyalists turned out to support them. When 9 months later the British left to fight elsewhere, the loyalists who had exposed themselves became easy targets for angry rebels. Loyalists thereby learned a painful lesson: don't support the British. Ambrose Searle, a British officer, recognized this crucial problem. In May of 1778, when Searle learned of British plans to evacuate Philadelphia, he described the reaction of a loyalist friend.
"It filled my poor friend, as might be expected, with horror and melancholy. He was now left to wander like Cain upon the earth without home and without property. Many others are involved in the like dismal case for the same reason: attachment to their king and country, and opposition to a set of daring rebels."
In Searle's judgment, the abandonment of Philadelphia vanquished all hope for a British victory in America.
"I now look upon the contest as at an end. No man can be expected to declare for us when he cannot be assured of a fortnight's protection. Every man, on the contrary, whatever might have been his primary inclinations, will find it his interest to oppose and drive us out of the country."
After the capture of Philadelphia, General Howe encamped most of his army around the nearby community of Germantown. Then, for the first time during the war, Washington took the offensive. On October 4, 1777, he attacked the British in force. Washington's plan was complicated, too complicated in the opinion of many historians. After a night march, four columns were to converge and attack the British simultaneously, trapping them in a pincer movement. After a promising beginning, the battle went awry for the Americans and turned into a rout. Two American columns, blinded by fog and heavy smoke, fired on each other. The British counterattacked and pursued the retreating Americans for 10 miles. The Americans lost 1,100 men, twice as many as the British. Though defeated, American soldiers had fought well at Germantown, and this boosted their morale. As one officer said,
"Though we gave away a complete victory, we have learned this valuable truth:
that we are able to beat the British by vigorous exertion, and that we are far superior in point of swiftness. We are in high spirits. Every action gives our troops fresh vigor and a greater opinion of their own strength. Another bout or two must make the British situation very disagreeable.
Some Americans blamed Washington for the defeats at Brandywine and Germantown, and there were hints he should be replaced as commander-in-chief. Jonathan Sargent, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, declared,
"Thousands of lives and millions of property are yearly sacrificed to the insufficiency of our commander-in-chief. Two battles he has lost for us by two such blunders as might have disgraced a soldier of 3 months' standing. And yet we are so attached to this man that I fear we shall rather sink with him than throw him off our shoulders."
In December 1777, Washington chose a site to lodge his army for the winter, Valley Forge, located 20 miles from Philadelphia. "This inhospitable terrain," growled one critic, "must have been selected on the advice of a speculator, a traitor, or a council of ignoramuses." Around 2,500 men, a quarter of Washington's army, perished during the six-month encampment. A 27-year-old soldier left a gripping account of Valley Forge in his diary.
"December 14th. Poor food. Hard lodging. Cold weather. Fatigue. Nasty clothes. Nasty cookery. Vomit half my time. Smoked out of my senses. The devil's in it. I can't endure it. Why are we sent here to starve and freeze? What sweet felicities have I left at home? A charming wife, good food, good cookery. All agreeable, all harmonious. Here, all confusion, smoke and cold, hunger and filthiness, a pox on my bad luck. Here comes a bowl of beef soup, full of burnt leaves and dirt. Away with the boys. I'll live like a chameleon upon air."
The British had triumphed in Philadelphia, but this victory was more than offset by their crushing defeat in the Northern theater of war. In June 1777, a month before Howe embarked for Philadelphia, another British general, Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, had set out from Canada with a force of 9,500 men. Burgoyne planned to sail southward on the Lake Champlain Lake George Waterway and from there proceed along the Hudson River to Albany, New York. This plan, known as the Hudson Line Strategy, had long been in the minds of British planners. By controlling the waterways from Canada to New York, the British hoped to isolate New England, the nucleus of rebellion. When Burgoyne set sail, he figured his main obstacle would be the American-held Fort Ticonderoga, located on the western side of Lake Champlain. But Burgoyne captured the fort with surprising ease. Known as the Gibraltar of America, Ticonderoga was considered so important that when King George learned of its capture, he exclaimed, "I have beat them. I have beat the Americans." Burgoyne was now only 70 miles from Albany, and it seemed nothing could stop him. But he made a fatal error. Instead of sailing southward on Lake George, Burgoyne chose to march overland through marshes, ravines, and dense forests. The Americans made this terrain even rougher by blocking Burgoyne's path with felled trees, boulders, and man-made swamps. Many of Burgoyne's men were ill-equipped for a trek through the wilderness. This was especially true of the German dragoons, the name given to cavalrymen who rode into battle but dismounted to fight. These dragoons were encumbered by stiff leather breeches, great cocked hats, 6-pound jackboots, long spurs, and broadswords. On July 29th, after taking 24 days to cover just 23 miles, Burgoyne reached the Hudson River. The delay caused by his overland march gave the rebels precious time to marshal their forces. Burgoyne was short of supplies, cattle, and horses. So before pushing on to Albany, he sent 800 men on a foraging expedition to Bennington, Vermont. These men, many of them Germans, were accompanied by a German band whose job, presumably, was to herald Burgoyne's victorious entry into Vermont. Instead, this force was surrounded and mauled by American militia units from Vermont and New Hampshire. The Battle of Bennington was fierce. A German officer described the action.
The scene which ensued defies all power of language to describe. The bayonet, the butt of the rifle, the saber, the pike were in full play, and men fell, as they rarely fall in modern war, under the direct blows of their enemies. But such a struggle could not be of long continuance. Outnumbered, broken, our people wavered and fell back, or fought singly and unconnectedly, till they were either cut down at their post or compelled to surrender.
Militiamen from nearby areas won the Battle of Bennington. The militia might refuse to serve long enlistments or to fight far away from their homes, but when their own soil was threatened, the militia fought bravely and well. These militiamen cared little for the formalities of conventional warfare. For example, before the Battle of Bennington, some Germans were approached by a column of militiamen wearing white paper badges on their hats, the insignia of American loyalists. The Germans, assuming these were friendly Americans, held their fire. Then, at close range, the Americans attacked. A month later, General Burgoyne's army crossed to the west bank of the Hudson River. Between Burgoyne and Albany stood the Northern American Army, 7,000 men, under the command of General Horatio Gates, a former British officer. On September 19th, the two armies engaged at Freeman's Farm, between the villages of Saratoga and Stillwater. The British won the field of battle, but they lost 600 men, twice the American casualties. Many of the British casualties were officers, thanks to the sharpshooting of Daniel Morgan's famed rifleman. Lieutenant Anbury, a British officer, described the horrible aftermath of the battle.
I saw 15, 16, and 20 buried in one hole. Heads, legs, and arms above ground. No other distinction is paid to officer or private than the officers are put in a hole by themselves. Our army abounded with young officers, and in the course of this unpleasant duty, 3 of the 20th Regiment were interred together, the age of the eldest not exceeding 17. This was nothing to the scenes in bringing in the wounded. The one were past all pain, the other in the most excruciating torment, sending forth dreadful groans. They had remained out all night, and from the loss of blood and want of nourishment were upon the point of expiring. Some of them begged they might lay and die. Others again were insensible. Some, upon the least movement, were put in the most horrid tortures. And all had near a mile to be conveyed to the hospitals. Others at their last gasp, who for want of our timely assistance must have inevitably expired. These poor creatures, perishing with cold and weltering in their blood, displayed such a scene. It must be a heart of adamant that could not be affected by it, even to a degree of weakness.
Burgoyne's situation was grim. Unlike the Americans, he could not replace men lost in battle. Burgoyne had been told that loyalists would flock to his standard, but they never came. His Indian allies slipped away by scores, and many Germans wandered into the woods never to return. Burgoyne offered a reward for the scalps of deserters. Burgoyne's army lived on salt pork and flour, and their already meager portions were cut by a third. Horses died of starvation. Burgoyne's 5,000 men faced a growing American army of 11,000 men, well-fed, determined, and firmly entrenched on Bemis Heights, a densely wooded plateau north of Stillwater. On October 7th, the two armies fought again. The Americans won a decisive victory thanks largely to the heroism of Major General Benedict Arnold, a man who had distinguished himself in previous actions and who would later betray the American cause. The British retreated to the village of Saratoga, where they were surrounded and bombarded with ceaseless cannon fire. Baroness Riedesel, the wife of a German officer, described the terror.
11 cannonballs went through the house, and we could plainly hear them rolling over our heads. One poor soldier, whose legs they were about to amputate, having been laid upon a table for this purpose, had the other leg taken off by another cannonball in the very middle of the operation. His comrades all ran off, and when they again came back, they found him in one corner of the room, where he had rolled in his anguish, scarcely breathing. I was more dead than alive, though not so much on account of our own danger as for that which enveloped my husband, who, however, frequently sent to see how I was getting along and to tell me that he was still safe.
Burgoyne opened negotiations with General Gates, the American commander. Gates, fearing Burgoyne was about to be reinforced, settled for less than a surrender. An agreement or convention was reached whereby the British soldiers would be returned to England provided they agreed not to fight again. The Saratoga Convention was signed on October 17, 1777, but both sides tried to violate it. Consequently, Burgoyne's army was marched to Virginia as prisoners. Many historians consider Saratoga to be the turning point of the war. This victory convinced Europeans that Americans could defeat the British. France, seeking to avenge her losses from the Seven Years' War, declared war against Britain in 1778. Spain followed suit the following year. The American Revolution had escalated into a European conflict. America became a secondary consideration for Britain. She needed to focus on her European rivals. In 1778, Britain began removing troops from America to defend the West Indies from the French Navy. With her forces in America weakened, the British devised a fresh strategy. Under a new commander-in-chief, Henry Clinton, they launched a southern offensive. Once again, the British sought the Holy Grail, victory based on support from American loyalists. This time, they almost found it. The British conquered Georgia quickly, and they followed up with their greatest victory of the war. In May 1780, the British captured Charleston and the entire American Southern Army, some 5,500 men. With this impressive victory in hand, General Clinton returned to New York and left the Southern campaign to General Cornwallis, an able commander. After the fall of Charleston, Congress appointed General Gates to lead a new Southern Army. Beginning in North Carolina, Gates marched to Camden, South Carolina. There on August 16, 1780, he fought the army of General Cornwallis. The American battle plan was poorly conceived. General Gates entrusted untrained militia with the entire left side of the American line. Militiamen fought well when entrenched behind fortifications, but when faced with fearsome bayonet attacks in open field combat, they were no match for British regulars. If General Gates didn't know this, he learned it the hard way at Camden. An American colonel, Otho Williams, recalled the disaster.
The impetuosity with which the British advanced, firing and huzzaing, threw the whole body of the militia into such a panic that they generally threw down their loaded arms and fled in the utmost consternation. A great majority of the militia, at least two-thirds of the army, fled without firing a shot.
Unlike the militia, the regulars of the Continental Army stood their ground at Camden.
He who has never seen the effect of a panic upon a multitude can have but an imperfect idea of such a thing. The best disciplined troops have been enervated and made cowards by it. Like electricity, it operates instantaneously. Like sympathy, it is irresistible where it touches. But in the present instance, its action was not universal. The regular troops, who had the keen edge of sensibility rubbed off by strict discipline and hard service, saw the confusion with but little emotion. They engaged seriously in the affair.
Gates lost nearly his entire army at Camden, 1,800 men killed, wounded, and captured. Thus, between the fall of Charleston and the defeat at Camden, a span of 4 months, the Americans had lost two armies. Georgia and South Carolina were largely controlled by the British, and General Cornwallis set his sights on North Carolina. but Cornwallis still had to contend with bands of guerrilla fighters who were harassing British outposts in South Carolina. Patrick Ferguson, a young British major, was given command of 1,000 American loyalists and told to deal with the problem. Many guerrilla fighters hailed from west of the Blue Ridge Mountains in present-day East Tennessee. Major Ferguson issued an ultimatum to these rugged frontiersmen. If they didn't cease their hit-and-run raids, Ferguson would march his loyalists over the mountains and, in his words, lay waste their country with fire and sword. Ferguson was a talented officer, but he didn't know much about the psychology of American frontiersmen, or backwater men, as Ferguson called them. Armed with hunting knives and rifles, 1,000 frontiersmen swept through the mountain gaps into North Carolina. On October 7th, they caught up with Ferguson at King's Mountain, just inside the border of South Carolina. More than any other battle of the Revolution, the Battle of King's Mountain featured opposite kinds of warfare. Ferguson's loyalists used muskets and attacked with bayonets. The frontiersmen used rifles and crept up the hill Indian style, firing from behind cover. Some frontiersmen shot and stabbed loyalists as they tried to surrender. Major Ferguson was killed. 300 loyalists were killed or wounded, and 700 were taken prisoner. 9 of these loyalists were later hanged as traitors. At least they died quickly. Some of the wounded loyalists, mistreated and neglected, died slowly in agony. King's Mountain was the first major setback in Britain's southern campaign. General Cornwallis postponed his conquest of North Carolina and withdrew into South Carolina. Meanwhile, Congress, following the advice of Washington, had appointed General Nathanael Greene to command yet another southern army. This was a happy choice. Over the next 10 months, Greene, the fighting Quaker, would distinguish himself as America's most brilliant general. Nathanael Greene was a Rhode Islander who had never ventured south of the Potomac. But Greene chose subordinates who were native Southerners, men skilled in guerrilla tactics. These included Daniel Morgan from Virginia, Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox from South Carolina, and Thomas Sumter, the Carolina Gamecock, also from South Carolina. Greene's army in North Carolina was small, only 1,600 men. Most of them were poorly clothed and poorly equipped militia. Unlike his predecessor, Horatio Gates, Greene knew he could not defeat Cornwallis in conventional warfare. Instead, Greene chose to fight what he called a fugitive war, a war of hit and run designed to wear down the British. Moreover, Greene understood the need to maintain the goodwill of civilians. He put an end to pillaging by American troops. Greene divided his army, entrusting 600 of his best soldiers to Daniel Morgan. Morgan's men marched into South Carolina, where they planned to harass the enemy's left flank and rear. Greene explained the strategy.
It makes the most of my inferior force, for it compels my adversary to divide his, and holds him in doubt as to his own line of conduct.
As Greene expected, Cornwallis divided his army, sending a detachment under Bannister Tarleton to pursue Morgan. Tarleton chased Morgan to Cowpens, an area used for cattle grazing near South Carolina's border. There, on January 17, 1781, Morgan turned, fought, and won an impressive victory against well-trained British dragoons. The key to Morgan's victory was his deployment of militia, men who often panicked when attacked in an open field. Morgan, unlike other American generals, did not hold the militiamen in contempt. Indeed, he saw no reason why the militia, after firing their muskets, should stand and be slaughtered by an oncoming cavalry. Morgan told his militia to fire only 3 volleys and then retreat behind a line of regulars. One American, Thomas Young, told how Morgan reassured his men the night before the battle.
It was upon this occasion I was more perfectly convinced of General Morgan's qualifications to command militia than I had ever before been. He went among the volunteers, helped them fix their swords, joked with them about their sweethearts, told them to keep in good spirits and the day would be ours. "Just hold up your heads, boys. 3 fires," he would say, "and you are free. And then when you return to your homes, how the old folks will bless you and the girls kiss you for your gallant conduct." I don't believe he slept a wink that night.
Morgan's militiamen did their job, and Tarleton was routed at the Battle of Cowpens. Americans took heart as news of Morgan's stunning victory spread throughout America. One Western Carolinian remembered Cowpens in a public prayer.
There is the great and glorious battle of King's Mountain, where we killed the great General Ferguson and took his whole army. And the ever-memorable and glorious Battle of the Cowpens, where we made the proud General Tarleton run down the road helter-skelter. And, good Lord, if ye had not suffered the cruel Tories to burn Billy Hill's iron works, we should not ha' asked any mere favours at thy hands. Amen.
Cornwallis was infuriated by the defeat of Tarleton's crack legion. He chased Morgan through North Carolina, where Morgan reunited with General Greene. The entire Southern army then raced across the Dan River, just over the Virginia border, with Cornwallis in hot pursuit. Cornwallis lacked boats, so he turned back to Hillsborough. Greene's army dogged his footsteps. In North Carolina, General Greene decided to tackle Cornwallis in a conventional battle. On March 15, 1781, the two armies engaged at the Guilford Courthouse, west of Hillsborough. The British won the field, but Cornwallis lost a quarter of his army. As an English critic observed, another such victory would ruin the British army. After the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, General Greene marched the American army into South Carolina.
I am determined to carry the war immediately into South Carolina. The enemy will be obliged to follow us, or give up their posts in that state. If the former takes place, it will draw the war out of North Carolina, and give it an opportunity to raise its proportion of men. If they leave their posts to fall, they must lose more there than they can gain here. If we continue in this state, the enemy will hold their possessions in both.
In South Carolina, the British had established a string of posts along the Santee River and its tributaries. They had 8,000 men in the Deep South, many of them Loyalists. By contrast, Greene's army had only 1,500 men. Cornwallis chose not to pursue Greene. He believed the Loyalists in South Carolina could hold their own. But Cornwallis underestimated the strength of American guerrilla fighters in South Carolina. Greene used these forces effectively. While suffering a few setbacks, the rebels captured one post after another. By summer's end, in 1781, the British had lost most of the Deep South, retaining only Savannah and Charleston. In other words, after a year and a half of their southern campaign, the British were back where they started. In 1781, American and French forces converged on Yorktown, Virginia, a sleepy village on the bank of the York River. The French Navy had cut off Chesapeake Bay, so Cornwallis had no place to go. At 2 p.m., October 19, 1781, 7,200 British troops surrendered at Yorktown. The British band struck up an appropriate tune, "The World Turned Upside Down." When news of the surrender reached Philadelphia, a night watchman of German descent spread the good news. Swinging his lantern, he shouted over and over, "Basht drie o'glock! Und Cornwallis ist Deken." Yorktown was the last significant battle of the American Revolution. Britain, at war with other European countries, could no longer afford to pour men and money into the American conflict. 2 years after Yorktown, America and Britain signed an official peace treaty. In December 1776, when Americans were suffering one defeat after another, Thomas Paine penned these stirring words.
"These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated."
Americans had won their independence. Now it was up to them to preserve the liberty for which so many had given their lives.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of The American Revolution by Knowledge Products. The script for this presentation is by George H. Smith. Script edited by Wendy McElroy. Produced by Pat Childs. Vocal characterizations are by Dan Church, Rob Daniel, Mike Edwards, Pat Childs, Marshall Falwell, Travis Hardison, Don Jones, Irv Kane, Joe Keenan, Paul Meyer, Mike Miller, Fred J. Scole, John Sherberg, and Robert Wynn. Music is by Ralph Childs. Recorded at the Village Recorder and Archer Productions. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1989 by Carmichael and Carmichael Incorporated. This presentation of the United States at War is a part of the Audio Classics series, a continuing series presenting the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.